late bulletin says we just turned on the air conditioning.
Yeah.
Well, I don't expect to be able to give John's lecture, because I really do not know what he intended to say. But I will try to improvise a little on the theme of this factor of communication in regard to mental and physical ailments. I think that perhaps the Chinese have given us some very good background material. They recognize nature as the great instructor. They recognize the mountains and the rivers and the valleys, the flowers and the trees and the birds and everything that exists in nature as naturally having a benevolent influence. When we get worldly weary, we often escape to the country, to some retreat where we can rest in the presence of a tremendous ministry of natural value, which is not accompanied by any verbal instruction. Nature does not teach by words. It does not preach to us in verbalizations. It rather simply exists as it is. And we find this existence as it is very desirable, very helpful, and revitalizing after the pressures of confusion. Therefore, we may say, in the Chinese way of thinking, that the more we live with the confusions of humanity, the more weary and sick we are apt to become, and that our greatest physician is nature itself. That nature, in its own proper way, asks to be understood and interpreted. It is up to us, really, to discover the values in nature. But one of the reasons why we are impelled to do this is because we already experience or feel some quality, some value that we cannot find in the congestion of human relationships. The Sung painters, the Sumi masters of both Japan and China have given us wonderful pictorial scenes which reach into our natures, so that actually a picture is a sermon without words. It tells us something we experience inwardly. It stimulates our intuitive reaction and becomes a balm in Gilead. We feel better, more peaceful, for the painting becomes a window into a universal existence. Now, we realize in some way that the more natural we can be in a constructive sense, the better our health is apt to be. Anything that is artificial or sophisticated endangers our peace of mind and also the harmony of our bodily functions. If, therefore, we recognize that the universe in which we live is continually communicating with us, not with words or preachments, but with the mere fact of its own statement of existence, what it is, what it does, what it means. Now, in a smaller but very personal way, the human body also communicates with us at all times. We do not necessarily recognize this communication. In fact, in many instances, we know it only as a pain reflex, in which a troubled body is trying to express the urgency of its needs. On the other hand, the normal, healthy body communicates as nature does, simply by the adequacy of itself, by the fact that it becomes a useful and patient protector of our purposes and contributes to the fulfillment of our various objectives. The ancients, therefore, regarded the body with great reverence. They considered it to be a proper symbol of the divine order and the divine harmony. Like the universe, it does not necessarily verbalize anything, but it does, in one way or another, express itself. Sometimes through symbolism, sometimes through reflexes, sometimes through symptoms which require careful consideration. Therefore, the body again is another instrument of nonverbal communication. And this is perhaps the grand term to cover all of the examples of life that become our teachers. Examples that are not put into words, do not appear in textbooks, but which continuously influence us. The human being, by nature, is natural. He is part of the world in which he lives. But gradually, the average person has alienated natural pressures and circumstances. He has built cities in which the communication factor is seriously offended. He moves into congestion. He lives under a variety of pressures, most of which are against the well-being of his own nature. Some of these pressures damage his body. Others outrage his emotions. And others again afflict his thoughts. But nearly all the problems that afflict us are artificial. They arise from mutual ignorance, indifference, or unreasonable ambitions. Some of them arise from the facts that we cannot get over grudges, cannot forgive our enemies, and cannot tolerate the success of other people. All of these different pressures move in. They also are, for the most part, nonverbal. They may be communicated to us by other persons, watched over television programs, or read in the press. But still, the circumstance itself is not speaking. It is not telling us something. But in the various media, this circumstance is already conditioned. The media does not tell us the real emotional core of a situation. It interprets it already, and we begin to accept the interpretations and are variously influenced, not by the circumstances, but by the way other people have reacted to them. If reactions are artificial, they again become a nonverbal source of tension and stress. Today we have a great deal of bad health, and at the same time we have a tremendous number of well-intentioned people who would like to improve their own health and dispositions and contribute something to the solace of society. We can then begin to study some of these factors. How do we communicate nonverbally? How does the human being share with other human beings values which cannot or are not put into words? Well, we can again go to nature for a little information or a little parallel. Take, for example, a person who lives alone and whose principal companion is a faithful dog or cat. This dog cannot speak, but it appears to be a good listener. We do not know exactly what its thoughts are, but we do know that in a mysterious mood, it seems to sympathize with our needs. It becomes a close value in our lives and expresses its concern through a series of very simple gestures. It comes toward us when we are lonely. It is with us when we have some problem burdening our souls. It may rest at our feet in a quiet evening, but in some way the animal gives us one tremendous consolation. We are not alone. And this presence of something means gradually that we build into this presence almost all of the characteristics of humanity.
As far as we are concerned, when we speak to the animal, we are inwardly impelled to believe it understands us. We share our secrets with a perfect realization that the confidence will never be betrayed. We also find all kinds of ways of pleasing this little creature that has become part of our lives. We may take great pleasure in doing little favors for it. And very often, the little animal becomes very responsive to these favors and becomes almost demanding of them. But we do live in the presence of a non-communicating creature that at the same time has the power to seriously and considerably influence our own attitudes. We also find that frustrated care or affection come out to the little animal when they do not bestow themselves upon persons. We have in the pet something that is dependable, something that we do not have to deceive. We do not find it necessary to have subterfuge. It simply is a matter of open communication without verbalization. And this is very important in the lives of a great many human beings. Another example is the fact that the body itself is a communicating instrument, entirely apart from speech and sight and the other faculties that we know. Dr. Kumaraswamy, the great Indian art critic, philosopher, and connoisseur, once observed in his book, The Ministry or Language of Gesture, how in antiquity and all through the life of civilization, gestures have become means of communication. The body, assuming various postures, tells stories. It gives us various concepts of rhythm. It also provides us with internal means of expressing feeling and thought without verbalization. We know, for instance, as Dr. Lavater, the famous physiognomist, pointed out, that a person can tell the whole story of himself without speaking a word. That also he can share his convictions and his attitudes with others without actually speaking. Lavater was able to look at a person and was able to tell by little involuntary symbols that this person presented most of his character and what his tendencies in life were likely to be. Also, we find that appearance, a subtle influence, comes from the person, which can be registered by another sensitive individual. I remember a story that I knew the persons involved in long ago, and that is a bank teller who was waiting to cash a check for a customer, and all of a sudden he said he knew that the person was dishonest. He knew that the man did not have the account that he claimed to have, that the check was not legitimate, but there was nothing spoken. So he did not cash the check. The man was dishonest, and the bank would have been defrauded. And asked how he knew this, felt this, he said there were little mannerisms on the part of the man trying to cash the check, mannerisms that added up to tension, stress, deceit. And the teller felt it without knowing how or why. So the body is continually telling stories about itself. In India, there are certain character analysts who invite a person to have a character reading. The individual to receive the readings, they simply sit quietly on the floor or on a chair, and the analyst studies him. Not a word is spoken for a half an hour or more. During that period of time, the client has moved around a little, maybe scratched an ear, raised a hand, opened or closed a fist, shifted a leg, and the analyst has watched all of these movements with greatest care. And from these little symbols, he can give a fantastically accurate description of the person's character. Thus, we do have the problem of this non-verbal sharing of knowledge. Now, it becomes more intimate as we become closer to people. It is very much in experience that we learn the natures of each other. If we are living with another person, if we have children who are with us most of the time, we intuitively come to recognize their moods and their reactions to circumstances. And little by little, we get an intimate realization of their inner lives, which makes it possible for us to work with them nonverbally. We can share their sorrow without speaking, but by a gesture, as Kumaraswamy calls it. We can show a slight indication of feeling, which the other person instantly recognizes and finds it consoling or damaging according to the mood or emotion behind it. Psychology has shown the danger of critical attitudes. It has shown how persons have concealed antagonisms for half a lifetime, or tried to. But the person against whom this antagonism was directed was fully aware of it, although it was never discussed. There was a reaction of restraint, of suspicion, of irritation, whenever these two persons came together. And it was inevitable that these subtle reactions should be communicated. Pythagoras and Socrates and many others in the ancient classical world made a great deal of the dance as a medium of communication. They were fully aware that by various rhythms and motions of the body, the individual expressed not only his physical reactions to life, but also his deepest spiritual and religious attitudes and emotions. The Pythagoreans danced at the dawn every day as a symbol of worship. Worship being the individual attempting to release through his own body the harmony of life. That each individual had a certain personality of his own. Therefore, although they were all dancing to the notes of a lute or a drum, each one was dancing a little differently. And this difference was a key to his own individuality and to the relation that he had between his own personal life and his veneration for the deities. Socrates, who was not exactly a graceful man, he is reported to have been a bow-legged and pigeon-chested, actually, however, danced with his disciples. And according to a stranger who came to Athens, he asked how he would know Socrates. And he was told that Socrates was a person of very poor appearance, rather deformed. But later, when the man met Socrates, he reported that he found him to be handsome, beautiful, and wonderful. The spirit behind, the life behind, was so magnificent that it completely overshadowed any defect of the body. Now, to a measure, we are under these problems today. Today, I suppose, as never before, human beings have tried to improve appearance. They have used every possible means to make the body more attractive. Both in clothing and in dieting and in all these ways, they want to look well. But very few of them have really discovered that beauty comes from inside, and that a person of very ordinary appearance becomes beautiful by release of internal values. No one can be truly beautiful who is not growing wiser inside. And we cannot have physical beauty that is real unless we also have friendship and affection inside the person involved. They must be communicated through appearance. And the more the inner life is ennobled, the more attractive the outer personality becomes. We look over the gallery of the immortals, and the most honored of human beings have not been the best looking. But their appearance has been ennobled by their conduct, and their value to civilization has been increased by the contributions that they made to life. Therefore, we look upon faces like the face of Abraham Lincoln. And while it was not a handsome face, some way it looks beautiful. There's something behind it. The non-physical means represents or experiences when viewing pictures of the great president. Now, another way of non-verbal communication is music. Music has been a tremendous factor in the life of the individual. Music is melodic or harmonic when it is contributed from orchestration or musicians individually. Actually, however, the harmonics of music is the result of lawfulness, mathematics, great skill and artistry. And music can be a tremendously vital factor in the improvement of mankind, but only if the music that we hear is alchemically transmuted in ourselves to the highest form of musical vibration. Therefore, we find that discords of all kinds endanger health, endanger the development of character. We must have the music that is harmonic. In Athens, a composer who wrote a piece of music that was not harmonic could be exiled or imprisoned for this sin against the community. Music representing a perfect harmony of sounds also becomes apparent in structures that are created upon musical themes. And these structures include a great number of architectural works. Many buildings of antiquity especially were crystallizations of harmonic patterns. They were deeply involved in music and in the harmony and grace of a kind of melodic consciousness within the soul of the architect. We notice even today the tremendous difference of effects resulting from various types of architecture. We realize that some artistic forms ennoble us, raise our vibratory rates, and cause us to have a feeling of sublimity, whereas others become totally materialistic, comparatively valueless as contributing anything, and bringing no satisfaction, unfoldment, or release of the psychic life within us. So architecture is a very valuable and important element in the non-verbal communication. It tells us much about the ability that we have to appreciate. I think that one is faced with a variety of reactions to architecture. To some people, architecture is simply a roof and four walls. What it is like, why it is there, is purely a matter of utility. And as utility, it nourishes only that for which the utility is intended. If it is an office building or a bank or a stock exchange, then the building becomes simply the structure or principle upon which the building is erected. There is no idealism, there is no overtone involved in works of this kind. Churches used to be very much affected by religious architectural principles. But in the course of time, the attitude of the average person toward religion has greatly changed. Even today, however, I noticed in entering into a great cathedral or some magnificent religious structure that even those who have no particular interest in that particular religion some way become silent. They take off a hat or they do something to indicate respect without realizing what they are doing. They are simply under the pressure of a great harmony, a tremendous spiritualized pattern, a kind of cosmic snowflake, something that is mathematically, psychologically, mystically correct. And wherever a structure is properly organized, it does create a feeling within ourselves. Plotinus, in his essay on the beautiful, has clearly discussed this particular subject. The soul of man is a mysterious, abstract power which dwells in the innermost and is lured out into manifestation essentially by beauty. In his essay on the beautiful, Plotinus points out that the beauty in the human soul moves outward to embrace the beauty of the world, that the human soul, being beautiful and symmetrical, reaches out to the natural world of mountains and valleys and wonderful streams and lakes. And the soul is happy. The soul is happy and it is nourished because it is fed by beauty. And having been properly nourished and properly fed, the soul becomes a source of joy, peace, and insight within the individual. If, however, the soul is confronted with asymmetry or deformity, if it must listen to discords of sound, look upon discords of color and shape, and live in the atmosphere only of a factory-ridden civilization, the soul retires further and further back into itself, suffering or locked by the fact that there is no nourishment for it in the world in which many people live and consider themselves to be satisfactorily integrated. If, therefore, the person, recognizing the fact that beauty is absent from his life, that he is not in the atmosphere of it, must do various things to communicate beauty to himself and through himself to his own soul. He can do this in a series of very simple actions. All that he has to do is find something that his own consciousness tells him is beautiful and try, if possible, to live with it. He may find art, he may find music, but if he finds any form of expression which ennobles him, which releases the finer parts of his own nature, it becomes a nourishment for the inner life and becomes a joy to the soul, which rushes forth to embrace its likeness in the world. Now, in human relationships, the problem of soul beauty is sometimes very difficult to determine. We find this in human relationships, in the relationship of parenthood or of marriage. We find that it's hard to understand why we choose the types of persons we do, or in bringing up children have certain choices as to how we hope they will grow and develop. Actually, however, there is a measuring rod within ourselves, a measuring rod that asks for beauty, asks for sustenance, seeks sympathy, companionship, and integrities. And where we find these, we are inevitably drawn to them. But if by any chance our own motives are ulterior, and we accept a compromise rather than clinging to our own convictions and principles, then in most cases our lives are not successful. We find that we have sacrificed the greater for the lesser when we sacrifice character for appearance. Because true appearance, in the truest sense of the mystical part of our own being, is a soul power manifesting through a body. L'Avatar brings this out quite firmly and so does Sanders in his study of physiognomy. He shows how every attitude that the individual holds ultimately changes his appearance. We do not necessarily understand how this happens, but from the bland, simple appearance of childhood, we gradually mature with other forms of appearance. We develop various character lines, and according to our characters, so are these lines. And if by various means we have unfolded a high potential, this is visible in our expression and in the organization of the parts of the face and head. If we have conflict inside, it will show in the structure and relationship of our features. If we are not symmetrically creating inward life, we will gradually deform the physical appearance, because it must ultimately bear witness to what we are. And the body must be a witness. But if the body is properly sustained by inward consciousness, it witnesses the growth of life within us and is correspondingly beautiful. Also in ancient times, the religious world made use of masks. Nearly all ancient religions had mask rituals, whether they be the Indians of the American Southwest, the Egyptian mysteries, or the Greek drama. All of these systems use masks to conceal the appearance of a mortal actor. The actor was supposed to be transformed by a mask into something that he was not, that he was gradually changed into the likeness of a deity or of an evil spirit or of a submaterial life of one kind or another. He had a transformation due to the wearing of the mask. Now, the ritualism of masks is very interesting. Among the Hopi, Navajo, and Zunis of the Southwest, the masks are, of course, sacred. One of the important points involved is that no one must wear the mask except during the ritual, and the mask must not be shown to other people. Also, the man who makes a mask must never see it himself until it is finished. Therefore, the religious masks of these Indians are made behind the back of the man who makes them. He puts his hands behind him to put the mask together. He must not look at it. Now, we find these masks also in Tibet. We find them in the religious rites of the lamas and of the ancient Chinese theater. They play an important part in the no drama of Japan. They are found in the rites and rituals of Java and other parts of Indonesia. Everywhere, the mask cult plays an important part in life. Now, the philosophy behind the mask, it seems to me, is this. Actually, it is a transformation of the personality. And the mask becomes very largely an artificial front by means of which we conceal the humanity of ourselves in a desperate effort to reveal the divinity, or else, in one way or another, to represent a member of some other order of life. Actually, almost all of us wear masks. They have become the inevitable factor in modern civilization. We may wear masks to appear better than we are, and there's scarcely a merchant who hasn't worn one for that reason at some time or other. The mask is not something that he puts over his face. The mask is what happens to his face. The mask is the fact that he has a face value that is different from character, that he makes promises he has no intention of keeping, that he makes himself as ingratiating as possible in order to deceive. All these masks also become involved in the kind of life that gradually develops around us. We gain one kind of mask through education. Through schooling, we take attitudes. We become associated with certain ways of life, certain thoughts, certain interpretations of existence. Later in professional life, we begin to speak through the mask, and our words as lawyers or doctors or engineers are very largely spoken through the mask of occupation, something we have put on that is not the real self. Now, the mystic, of course, and the esotericist is also trying to create a certain kind of appearance, a mask. He is, however, attempting to become a symbol of deity. The mystic, the idealist, hopes to become aware of the mask of a divine being or a divine power. And as the ritual dancers in the Hopi or Zuni rites wear these masks, they instantly become divine and are accepted as such. I've been at these dances where a father was a masked dancer. His children knew perfectly well who he was, that he was just father. But when the time for the ritual came and father approached them masked, carrying the sacred corn pollen, the children fell on their knees and venerated him as a deity. After it was over and the mask was put away, he went back home and he was father as he always had been. But under the mask of a god, he received a certain divine enlargement of character. Now, we all have these problems also. Nearly everyone has someone they have great respect for. If there is no one in a person's life that he respects, he's in a bad way. He is either keeping bad company or he is overlooking important values. It is far better to always recognize that the individual is wearing a mask and that this mask may cover his strength or it may conceal his weakness. And it is up to the individual involved to find out how these masks are actually worn. Sometimes we wear a mask in order to conceal grief. Sometimes we do it in order to arrange revenge. Sometimes we want to be considered better than we are. But almost always in the end, all masks have to be taken off. And in the last analysis, it is that which is behind the mask that must become the true value, of which the mask itself is only a passing symbol. In the Tibetan rites, masks very often represent the types of world in which we live. The monsters of the Tibetan underworld are right here among us. For this underworld is nothing but the material sphere in which we live. Here strange, grimacing, and frightening forms appear. Here all kinds of infirmities descend upon us. Here also the teachers appear to guide us and lead us out of the troubled underlife to something better and wiser. And in the ritual dances, all of these various conditions are personified for the enlightenment of the individual. The end of the enlightenment is always the same, that we shall recognize that all error, all weakness, all evil is delusional. And that actually behind every evil circumstance of life is finally a manifestation of the divine purpose for existence. Therefore, things wear many masks, but the truth is behind them and the truth is one, regardless of how it appears to be modified or conditioned or distorted by the circumstances of daily life. Then there are other forms of nonverbal communication. And these are, among others, service. One of the most powerful ways of sharing life with another is through dedication to the helpfulness which we feel within ourselves to be possible. Very often we have found, as Emerson found, that what we do speaks much louder than what we say. What we say becomes, therefore, a cover, a mask. And this mask of what we say is usually accepted by other people as genuine. This means that we have to be extremely careful what we say, far more careful than the average person likes to be. but by means of character, by means of dedication, we create a pattern of nonverbal idealism. The great teaching is by example. The great teaching is the individual doing those things which are the greater good to the greater number. We respect these people, even though we do not necessarily have the skill or courage to emulate their conduct. We respect achievement of a high quality, but may not at the moment feel that we can make the sacrifices or adjustments which would make it possible for us to become like these extremely important individuals. So that life itself becomes a form of communication, a form of understanding between the individual and the world around him. Another form of communication is meditation. And in this, the individual is communicating with that which words will not affect to any great degree. No matter how loudly we verbalize our prayers or our contemplations, the verbalizations are unimportant. The entire value of the meditative life lies in silent communion with reality. This is probably the highest form of nonverbal communication. It can be directed in three directions. First, it can be directed toward the divine power, the source of all life. Secondly, it can be directed toward an individual or group of individuals for which we have some special regard. And third, it can be directed toward ourselves. This meditative discipline is nearly always idealistic and unconditioned by material attitudes or interferences. Each person must in some way experience a contact with life. And this experience is the great communication. We call it a mystical experience sometimes. It is an experience in which for a moment the individual becomes intimately associated with the realities which he seeks to understand. He then discovers what all mystics have discovered, namely that there is no way of verbalizing the substance of a divine experience. There is no way in which the individual can communicate to another the actual experience. Various religious teachers and so forth have written of it, have tried to tell it to another person, have tried to share it with their disciples. But actually, the experience is beyond all communication. It is an identification with life itself. It is an at-one-ment with an eternal value. And this experience itself, of course, has been regarded as the greatest experience to which the individual can aspire. Plotinus, the great Neoplatonist, had one or two experiences of this kind. They lasted only a moment, but in that moment, time, distance, space, intervals, all instantly vanished. There was nothing but one tremendous reality. And the individual, for an instant, seemed to tune in on that reality and become with it.